streets, they shot, people down in the woods. And so, again, those murders were never prosecuted.
Well, we can't leave it there, so we're going to continue this conversation and bring you part two at democracynow.org. Paul Ortiz, professor of history and director of the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at University of Florida, Gainesville, and the Julia Wright, the daughter of the literary giant Richard Wright, who wrote Black Boy and Native Son. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Becca Staley. I'll be speaking at UPenn, at Penn State, and at Brown this week. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
When I first came to Brookhaven Town, way, hey, 9.1, there was no good music to be heard around. Way, hey, 9.1, then one day I turned on the dial. Way, hey, 9.1, there I found music to make me smile. Way, hey, 9.1, I waited for a legal ID. Way, hey, 9.1, the DJ said WUSB. Way, hey, 9.1. They start each day with the rising sun. Way, hey, 90.1. Don't ever finish till after day is done. Way, hey, 90.1. So if you want good music to hear. Way, hey, 90.1. There's a station in Stony Brook you ought to hear. Way, hey, 90.1. So if you like the sounds, do take a look. Way, hey, 90.1. At WUSB Stony Brook.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself. It's WUSB Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock. It's time, once again, for another edition of Off the Wall. very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes. Hi, I'm here.
Well, you know, this Ian storm, it just, it won't leave. We, of course, heard about the devastation in Florida, but it, the remnants of Ian have been with us here in the Northeast, in the New York area, since Saturday. It's now Tuesday. It's still here. It's still windy. It's still, you know, being pelted in the face with rain. And wow, I can't recall something lasting this long. Of course, it's nothing compared to what happened in Florida. You know, we have breezes of 30, 40 miles an hour at the most, but it's dramatic.
And Puerto Rico. Don't forget Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
Also recovering.
Well, that was mostly Fiona, I believe, that hit Puerto Rico recently.
Right.
And Fiona, of course, went up to Nova Scotia. You really need a map to follow it all. But Ian pretty much hit the southwestern part of Florida.
Yeah, it crossed over into the Gulf.
Now it's up here. Maybe it'll go to Nova Scotia, too. Hopefully not, but whoa. So, yeah, the second of the Shameless Kids. Carl is still coming. It begins with a K. I don't know where that storm is yet. Yeah, it's been really something seeing how horrible it's been for so many people down there. We thought it was going to hit Tampa Bay or the Tampa Bay area. It hit a little bit further south of that, Fort Myers, and Naples and places like that. And you know, we know some people down there, and it was very concerning trying to find out how everybody was making out. Fortunately, people we know are okay. But so many people are still being rescued, still without power, having their entire lives, you know, upended, businesses destroyed, Main Street destroyed. It looks like, you know, tornado damage when you look at the footage. And we've been doing a lot of that actually, because on YouTube there are live broadcasts of various TV stations down there. I believe it's NBC2 and ABC7 are simulcasting. Turns out they're owned by the same people, which is why they're simulcasting, even though they're part of different networks. But a lot of interviews, a lot of really dramatic footage, both during the storm and after the storm. And something else that kind of bugs me quite a bit, actually, campaign ads by Ron DeSantis in the middle of all this. I mean, look, we talked about this last week. When there's a hurricane and you're the governor, it can go either way. But it's usually in your favor if you don't totally screw something up. All you have to do is remain humble. This guy has not been remaining humble. If you were paying attention to what was going on down there, in addition to all the campaign ads, by the way, his opponent has not run any campaign ads. He has a little bit of decorum there, but Ron DeSantis, oh yeah, you know, I'm there for you in a crisis every 15 minutes, it seems. It's really so repulsive. But in addition to that, there has been some criticism of the response of the evacuation orders. And the reaction to that has been just about as bad as you could imagine it might be. I want to read you just a little bit of what happened. Governor Ron DeSantis, and this was back on Saturday, continued Saturday to defend the timing of evacuation orders by Southwest Florida officials amid lingering questions about whether they came too late for many residents. Now, what I notice here with DeSantis and with everybody else underneath DeSantis, they never take responsibility. I mean, you know, this is such a softball question. Could you have done better? Yeah, we could have done better. We didn't get everything right. We did as best we could. But as you know, a hurricane is unpredictable, and it can change at a moment's notice. You know, do I regret that we didn't issue the evacuation order a day earlier? Of course I regret that. Of course I would, but, you know, I stand behind the people who did the best they could, and did they make some mistakes? Yes, they made some mistakes, but for the most part, they did a good job. That's what you should have said. Instead, almost without exception, all these people, you know, working for DeSantis or allied with him in one way or another, they blame the people. They blame the people. They say things like, yeah, we could have issued the evacuation notice a day earlier, but, you know, people are just not going to leave anyway. They insist on staying. They won't listen to instructions, so why bother? Words like that. It always comes down to blaming the victims, never taking responsibility for yourself. It's so easy to do. It's so easy, and they can't do it. Ugh. All right, so let's see what he did say, all right? They were following the data, DeSantis said, in Fort Myers, about Lee County. That's where Fort Myers is. Lee County emergency managers who ordered evacuations Tuesday morning, a day before the deadly storm raced into the county with what he described as biblical storm surge, because you must get a Bible reference in there somewhere. Look, we were on the air a week ago. We knew this storm was going to hit and hit hard. We thought Tampa Bay, but Fort Myers, you know, it's on the way to Tampa Bay if you're a hurricane. So, definitely a good possibility that area, and island certainly, would be at great risk. So, I don't know. I'm not a governor, but if I were a governor, probably would have issued an evacuation order a lot sooner than that. Probably. DeSantis recounted the shifting path of Hurricane Ian, which was seen as likely targeting Tampa Bay shortly before an eastward turn brought it further south along the Gulf Coast. When we went to bed Monday night... You went to bed Monday night? What kind of governor goes to bed on the eve of a hurricane? I'm kidding. You can go to bed, but no more than 3 hours sleep, all right? When we went to bed Monday night, people were saying this is a direct hit on Tampa Bay. People. Your biggest enemy, people, were saying this. Worst case scenario for the state. He added that state and county officials have been reviewing how they evaluated the storm's course. But, again, not taking any responsibility. Continuing here, even if it goes to North Florida, if it's a big storm, you could see the impact in Naples and some of those areas, DeSantis said, but that's a different type of impact than what we ended up seeing. Because, as I mentioned earlier, hurricanes are unpredictable. Let's go to somebody else. County Commissioner Kevin Ruan said the county uses 6 weather models to make decisions. He said only one saw the chance of the storm changing direction to hit North Fort Myers. And he said, I got it. You blame somebody. The county screwed up. That's the story. You'll sell more newspapers. A certain number of people are going to agree with me. A certain number are going to say I did something wrong. Okay, defense of any? You know, you're in a county where a whole lot of people died, and there's all this destruction. At least some of it was preventable. Do you want to be part of the conversation that says, how could we have done better? Or you just want to hurl accusations at anybody who asks a question? Here's another commissioner, Brian Hammond. He said, anybody who has lived in Florida a long time understands the nature of a Floridian. The nature of a Floridian. Many of us have been through hurricanes before and have never seen something like this, where the storm surge actually happened the way it happened. Many people who heard the mandatory evacuation, which they had, which is still more than 24 hours, still made the choice to stay anyway. The nature of a Floridian. I think he's calling them morons. What happened? We followed the forecast, followed the data, followed the manual. Our team, they told me, they made the calls they needed to make. All right, there's one more commissioner. Mike Greenwell. Got a lot of commissioners down there. I think it's hindsight. Everyone is going to try to find something they can complain about. Yeah, that's the problem. People just want to find something to complain about. It's probably going to become a political... I'm sorry, it's probably going to become political, and that's a shame because we were all there saying pay attention. Sounds like you just made it political. People were asking generic questions of the people in charge. How is that political?
This doesn't sound like much of a recovery effort, you know. I mean, that's the other part of it. It's like after the storm leaves, you've got to make people right and help them get back there.
They're just so defensive. Let me finish with Mike Greenwell's comments here. We are down here trying to put our pieces back together, and we have people in other parts of the country criticize. That's a shame to me. That's what it is. Is everybody down there an idiot? I swear to God, I've never seen people so offended that anybody asks them a question about whether this was might have been a better... And you know, they're not people in other parts of the country. They're people right there in your backyard having a press conference. I see it. I see it on those TV stations I referenced before. They are asking you directly these questions. They are local reporters. They are the people who live there. And all you can do is blame them and then run another political ad for DeSantis. And that's another thing. You know, when we were watching these various press conferences, almost invariably, like it was some kind of, you know, Soviet-style press conference, they all praised DeSantis, saying, I am proud to be serving under this governor who has done... what's that word there? A tremendous job in keeping everybody safe. Now on to the next bootlicker. Yeah, disgusting. I mean, it was so easy. Like I said, it was so easy to get this right. You didn't have to do very much. You just had to show your face, be a little humble, be a human being. And instead, what we're seeing is shameless attempts to glorify yourself because you're on the verge of another election, and criticism of anybody who dares to ask a question. Meanwhile, your people are suffering, and that doesn't seem to be a priority. And you know what? It seems to be working. It seems to be working for DeSantis. He's pulling ahead in the polls. Can you believe that? His opponent, Crist, didn't run any ads because that was the right thing to do. Yeah, so that's the situation down there.
Yeah, I just find that, you know, when there's blood on their hands, generally it's not that big a deal. This seems like it's hit a chord with them in an unusual way. You know, putting people at risk and being reckless and not taking responsibility, I think, you know, in other scenarios hasn't fazed people like this in one way.
You know, I'm not even going to say they have blood on their hands. I mean, you know, when situations like this happen, invariably there are mistakes. But can you even acknowledge that any mistakes were made? They can't even do that.
Well, that's why I think it's striking and defensive feel or look. I mean, it's very sharply rejecting any kind of criticism at all. Like you said, questioning, and for what? I mean, yeah. I mean, you must think you've done something where people died, and you might be held to account if you're going to come that hard against any kind of questions.
Yeah, and to just see the press as the enemy constantly. It's that same thing we saw in the 4 years of Trump. You know, all the White House press conferences until they stopped having them altogether. Basically, from the very beginning, from the very first one, Inauguration Day, you are the enemy. You are fake. You are lying. You know, if the press is lying, if they are exaggerating, it will come out in the stories. People aren't stupid. They'll pick up on it. But when you just go into a situation with such hostility and defensiveness, it says a lot about you and your level of responsibility. So I wasn't expecting to see that, you know? I really wasn't expecting to see it play out that badly. I thought there'd be some fumbles, you know, but nothing on this level. It's just sad.
Yeah, a lot of people put their faith in that leadership, and I'm really conflicted about that area and the kind of development that goes on there. And you know, I don't want to see people hurt, but I also have my own critiques of what that's all about. How reliant they are on tourism, well, things, you know, like that. I mean, get real.
It's a place people have lived for a while. What's changing? It's climate change. There's no question about it. I mean,
right, but the very types of support that the preponderance of people there have put their voting prowess behind is causing that kind of change. Human cause. All this, like, unbridled carbon emission that we don't want to admit has anything to do with anything comes home big. And I just, I have a really difficult time trusting such paradox constantly. It's just really impossible. I have empathy and, you know, this is a big problem everywhere, but people that have voted outside their interests when they've been told that, you know, you want to connect all kinds of dots, maybe this giant one with massive companies and a whole lot of lobbyists, maybe that's one you should, like, you know, a rock you should overturn.
Yeah.
Why is that never questioned?
Because I think you might have identified it by saying when you were told. People tend to react against being told things. They want to arrive at the conclusion on their own. And I think sometimes, and, you know, I react badly to this conclusion that speaking down to people makes them act in a contrary way to what you would prefer. But it's a natural human instinct when someone is basically telling you that you don't know what you're doing and they do and you should do what they tell you to do the opposite. Unfortunately, this is hurting everybody. So we can do better with the message. I realize that. But you have to be able to interpret events. And what we're seeing so many storms of, you know, two storms in basically a week that were considered storms of a century or storms of even 500 years. And we're going to have to stop saying that because these storms are happening way too often now. You know, having Fiona and then Ian, and who knows? You know, it's just October. There could still be, you know, more. Not even taking into account rising oceans and warming temperatures and all sorts of other things. You look at the people currently leading down there, what they have said in the past about climate change, about global warming. And they've basically, you know, doubted the whole thing. Now it's hitting them. And you can't just say, well, it's just another storm. Because, you know, if it's a storm that happens once every 100 years, we should be good until the 22nd century. But we all know we won't be. So what does that mean? Something is changing. And we're the variable. We're the ones that are doing things that have changed the climate and will continue to change the climate. And we can't wait for the slowest people or the ones that are profiting the most to wake up and, you know, start changing their attitude. It'll be way too late then. So, yeah, you know, the ball's in the court of the people who elect these fools. And I'm just afraid it's going to happen all over again because of messaging, because people don't like the way they were talked to, or because, you know, somebody isn't effective at campaigning, or because somebody else basically has stacked the courts or, you know, figured out a way to prevent certain people from voting. All these dirty tricks. You know, we hate them, but they seem to work. And if, you know, this November, we're about a month away now, if Republicans gain anywhere after the harm they've caused to this country, I'm speaking specifically to taking away a woman's right to choose, and all the other attacks on civil rights and immigration and you know, laundry list of important things that this country is has stood for. If they are able to count any victories after these attacks, after trying to steal an election, I don't have much faith in the future. I really don't, because it can't get any more basic than saying, is this good or is this bad? And if we say, yeah, let's give them more of a chance, that's probably the last time you'll be asked that question. You know, it's democracy is not immortal. It's not impervious. I want to sound happier than this. I really do. But it's tough sometimes. It really is. Look, you see how people act. Judge them based on that. You see what people do when they're given power. Judge them based on that. And think carefully. Think carefully what's good, what's bad, what matters, what doesn't. I don't know, environment. I don't blame people for living where they live. You know, it's not easy to just give everything up and move away. And that's another thing. Evacuating. You ever evacuate? Kyle, you ever evacuate? It's not easy. It's not easy to just take everything that's important and go somewhere strange and prepare to live there for a few weeks. I mean, what if you don't even have a car? How do you evacuate then? Do they even think of these things when they say, oh, yeah, people should have evacuated? It's never as obvious as it seems to be on the days afterwards. And, you know, we saw all this with Katrina. We saw it with Sandy. That's another thing. I could just keep going all night with this. You know, DeSantis voted against hurricane aid to the victims of Sandy. He voted against it. And you better believe he wants as much hurricane aid from Ian as he can possibly get his hands on. As well he should, as the governor. But for God's sake, how do you explain yourself? How do you live with yourself? How can anybody vote for this guy and say, yeah, he's consistent?
The other thing is, these things, when they're planned long-term, when people are remediating things, it costs less when you prepare and you're investing ahead of time. After it hits, when you don't have evacuation plans, when people's housing, you know, along coastlines isn't remediated or otherwise dealt with, you know, relocated, I don't know what it has to be. It's not my job. I'm tired of it being my job to have answers to any of this. I have enough projects.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's going to come with his handout for more money than ever to the people he says are whatever crazy Satanists, the people that actually want to have a conversation about these topics. He's going to accuse of whatever he has to gain some political edge. And when he needs help the most, comes with his handout asking for the most amount of money instead of getting, you know, a plan in place ahead of time and a reasonable investment. You know, it's got to be worst case scenario, the most, the worst, and he'll campaign on it saying, whatever, I'm so cynical, I don't want to make up their cynical blaming, but you'll know it when you see it, and it's just the same BS over and over.
You know Biden's going to give him everything he asked for, as well he should.
Well, he will. He's a good guy. Democrats doing the right thing, being good, being magnanimous.
But never getting the credit for it, never having people remember this is what they did.
They'll get it, then they'll demonize the Democrats up and down, straight up and down, all the way into oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
And
because that's easy.
Good luck to them.
It's so easy they don't need luck, because it's very, very easy to demonize and to have hatred be the lasting emotion.
Yeah, but again,
gratitude is a lot harder, especially gratitude towards people you don't agree with.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know why. I guess it's something in our nature where it's just a lot easier to throw a stone than it is to.
Oh, well, I know that.
Let me finish the metaphor. It's a lot easier to throw a stone than it is to hold a flower. There, I'm done.
Profound.
Thank you. So, I'm glad you used the word Satanist, because that's the word that Vladimir Putin used as well this week in referring to people in the West.
Oh, I thought that's who we were talking about.
We were talking about DeSantis. I know it's hard to tell the difference sometimes, but they often do speak with the same barbed tongue. I don't even know if I want to get into the whole Ukraine thing now. Because you're just going to get in a bad mood by 7 o'clock.
I've been in a bad mood.
No, you were in a good mood when we started the show. This show basically turns Kyle into a bad mood every week.
Ruins me
every week. I'm sorry. Look, we could talk about baseball, but then I'll have to talk about the Mets and how they blew the entire series over the weekend.
That was depressing,
too. That was terrible. There's nothing good. Look, all the Mets had to do was win one of those games, and they would have been tied for first place with Atlanta with 3 games left this week. Okay? Now they have to win all 3 of those games, or Atlanta has to lose all 3 of those games for them to be in first place. Now, why does it matter? They're going to the playoffs regardless. Because when you're in first place, you get what's known as a bye, and you don't have to play the first round, and you get to rest. And resting is very important in baseball. That's what they do a lot of the time, is rest. That's what you do in the stands. You rest. Everybody's resting.
I heard the Mariners are in.
Are they in the play? Because, all right, you know, Kyle, I didn't want to say this.
I could
be
wrong. But.
Well, you could be wrong just for supporting them. No offense, but listen, the Mariners, Seattle Mariners, your hometown, they are the only team never to have played in the World Series.
Don't jinx
the
it.
The only
just
team.
Stop.
I'm not jinxing it. I'd be jinxing it if I said this is the year.
You're cursing it. That, what, why'd you say that?
Because I don't mean it.
Yeah, no, that's the truth.
No, I hope they I hope they make it to the World Series because...
You know, I'm so cynical, I don't even want to hear about the World Cup.
It's an embarrassment. Oh, the World Cup's coming up. Now, this is unusual, to have the World Series followed by the World Cup. That's never happened before. But because it's in a place that's like Venus, I think, is where they're holding it this year, where it's really hot, they have to have it in the winter. So that's going to be fun. And Canada's playing. I am stoked for Canada playing in the World Cup.
Heck yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mighty stoked.
Yeah, it's going to be good. It's going to be fun.
So, yeah, sports will take your mind off things.
Yeah, but I'm still depressed in the end because the Mets are still going to blow it. We know it. It always happens. You know, this is not only the first time that the Mets were in first place every single day of the year, it seemed, until the end. You know, I don't know what year it was. It was a bunch of years back, the early part of the 21st century. I just remember this picture of a crying kid on the back of one of the newspapers that summed up the entire season because on the very last day they blew it and they didn't make it to the playoffs. Every day before that, they would have made it, but not the last day. It was so sad, but so typical, too.
So, yeah, vanquish your enemies.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get to Ukraine. So, basically, our friend Vlad decided that he was going to take over more parts of the country simply by holding a quote-unquote referendum, basically saying, okay, we're gonna you know, have this vote. We're gonna have people go around. There's gonna be a soldier with them with a gun. They're gonna see what you vote for, and then we're gonna count them. And of course, you know, predictably, they got 98% of the vote to say, yeah, we'll go to Russia. That's where the guy with the gun comes from. So we're gonna say yes to that.
You saw the polling places. Every polling place had a Russian flag,
of course,
over the ballot box. Now, you'd think if the choice was one or the other, you'd have a Ukrainian and a Russian flag just so that people would know that was the choice. But it's almost like the answer was hanging in bright colors near the ballot box.
Look, we've talked about this before. And I've expressed my, you know, I guess, confusion as to why you would want to hold on to a part of the country that doesn't want to be part of your country. But in this particular case, after what has happened with invasions, with massacres, with torture, I don't care if it's, you know, if there's only one Ukrainian supporter in that region. That's not how you get to that place. They have shown their true colors, and they should not be rewarded for that at all. And, you know, I was even willing at the beginning of all this to say, yeah, you know, Crimea, that was part of the Russian Soviet Republic until Khrushchev decided it wasn't. But their actions, I think, have led to them forfeiting any right to have something like that, to march in with force and to try and use intimidation. That's not going to work. Maybe it worked at one point, but it's not going to work now.
Yeah, policies of appeasement have gotten us this to February 23rd.
Yeah, the day of the invasion. So, no. You know, Elon Musk even, he's going to buy Twitter after all, apparently.
He stepped in this.
He stepped in it yesterday by just, you know, posting one of these overly simplistic questions. I hate overly simplistic questions when you know the person asking them is basically has their own agenda and is just trying to lead you into a trap. But basically, why shouldn't the people in a particular part of Ukraine be able to vote on what country they want to be a part of? You know, making it seem like if you say no, they shouldn't join Russia because, quote-unquote, 98% of the people said so, it makes you seem like the one who's anti-democratic. When if you look at the bigger picture, it's quite obvious that Russia has been using fear and intimidation and all sorts of horrible tactics to get their way, and that this is not a true vote in any sense. The rest of the world can see that. And in light of what has been going on over the past few months, this is certainly not the time to be changing borders. So, no. I'm not walking into that trap. It's utter nonsense. And there's all kinds of other, you know, equally naive questions you could ask. You know, well, maybe Long Island doesn't want to be part of the United States anymore. You know, if I hold a referendum and only tell a couple of people about it and it's a 98% turnout or vote for what I want, then I guess you have to honor that. It's about as unfair. A little more ridiculous, but it's about as unfair. So, I don't know what's going to happen now. If you look at the military situation, Russia's not doing well. They basically tried to call up as many people as they could to fight this war, and it kind of backfired because people are now reacting against that invitation, and Putin is looking very weak because he can't do this. He can't win against Ukrainians.
You're not supposed to talk about how bad they're doing.
Oh, everyone's talking about how bad they're doing. Everyone's talking about this.
The numbers, sometimes they're high, uh-huh. Sometimes they're low. You know, what's a number?
Look,
it's not going in the right direction.
They've been chased out of the places they're trying to take over. Now, yesterday, I believe the Duma, I think is what it's called. They basically signed legislation, and it hasn't yet gone to Putin, believe it or not, for him to sign officially that these areas are now part of Russia. Once he does that, what does he do at that point? All his troops are fleeing. It's a little worrisome because I don't see him just backing down or changing his mind, even though that's really the only thing he can do at this point. What does he do? It seems like, you know, he's preparing to cut his country off from the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the Western world. It's worrisome. And, you know, if there was a way out of this, I would definitely explore it. But you can't just give up. You can't, like you said, appeasement is not the not the solution, especially in cases like this. You know, we're watching the documentary by Ken Burns. We started watching it. It's like 8 hours long, so you have to do it in stages. But it's what's the official title? The U.S. and the Holocaust.
The U.S. and the Holocaust.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I never realized how much we failed in that part of history. You always think of the United States as the ones who saved the day. In some ways we were, but in so many other ways, we turned a blind eye. You know, we didn't see what was happening, or we wouldn't support the people who were the victims. We turned away refugees. You know, it sounds very similar to what's happening today, where we don't want these people. They're taking away our jobs. They're dirty. They're not like us. Literally the same language. It really makes you think. And it's funny because I hear Republican criticism of Ken Burns, of all people. You know, documentarian, one of the best documentarians ever. And Republicans criticizing him for making it political, making the Holocaust political, making history political. Look, it's all about politics. But these are things that were said. These are things that happened. And I didn't know about a lot of them. I did not know. I mean, I knew Henry Ford was a racist. I didn't know how overtly racist he was. He would write pieces about how the Jews were taking over the banks and finances and society. It wasn't just a one-off. It was a series. He bought a newspaper, and he was running it in this newspaper. there were so many countless examples like this, so much that when I see the Ford emblem, I want to scratch it off. That name should not be seen as a positive thing in any way. I would never buy a Ford car, ever, after seeing this. But we're not taught this. We're not shown this. These are facts. This is history. And it's so important to study that. That's a good documentary, too. It's on PBS. You can find it in many ways.
Certainly. It's
and thank you, Kyle. You turned me on to it.
Well, it was promoted pretty heavily. I just really like to catch up with some of the stuff. There's so much good material, like media and interesting stuff out there. And this kind of goes along the lines of some of the fictional stuff we've seen. The last series that David Simon did was sort of along this line, although it was fictionalized.
With Lindbergh, yeah.
Yeah, I was talking about Lindbergh. And
another raging anti-Semite.
Yeah, and I just look around now, and I think a lot of people are reexamining this era, that era, to kind of make sense and grapple with some of what seems to be repeating itself in our own society now. And it really makes me reflect on, like, what peace is, what it will take to get to a place of sort of relative stability or peace in the world as we idealized it in the early part of the 21st century, maybe the last part of the 20th century. And I just find that it's a really curious parallel of history repeating itself and this struggle for power and it coming around to sort of ideals and so forth and how even a different church, like what will become of the Russian Orthodox Church after this, like how different even more or less aligned forms of Christianity are breaking. There's fissures that are being established between East and West, and those were some of the very things that occurred in Germany's history in the 80s, and when the wall came down, of course, and how the West is still grappling and trying to make sense of that. And I think we're so removed out here, we got to be reminded of it. I'm actually sitting on my grandfather's blanket, you know, that was with him in World War II. And I think about it a lot these days, seeing so much of very similar stuff. But we have more domains now, too. There's, like, all of this hype in militarization of cyber and all this stuff with space. It's almost out of, an action movie or, like, you know, Bond villains and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just almost caricature of the history, down to your dictators with these fiery speeches and saying awful things about places that now don't even have normal relations, nor normal diplomatic relations. All of that happening so quickly. Definitely revisiting the past can kind of at least guide you, your heart, into reconciling with so much of the trauma and finding what were the elements of good, how did people resist the temptations of the time?
You know, I think you can't have peace without justice. That, hence the battle cry: no peace, no justice. It's an illusion if you think you're living in peace and you're turning a blind eye to the injustice around you. I think that's what we're seeing now. People basically insisting that we confront certain issues and we challenge what people are saying and basically create the world we want to create. You know, we were talking about this as well, about what's going on in Iran right now, the horrible things that are happening to the demonstrators, to the women who are basically refusing to wear the hijabs because of what the morality police did to one poor girl. It's terrible. What really gets me, though, is seeing people on the right wing say that liberals can't can't criticize people or governments over there. And I don't know where they are getting this from. I don't know where they think that liberals aren't able to criticize horrible regimes like in Iran, like in Afghanistan, like in Saudi Arabia, for fear of being seen as Islamophobic. It's got nothing to do with the Muslim religion, any more so than criticizing Israel makes you anti-Semitic. It simply is, you're criticizing a nation, you're criticizing a government, you're criticizing oppression. You're not criticizing fundamental beliefs that many people have in one religion or another. That's a very different thing. And I believe you can point to any line in any holy book, including the Bible, that says something truly messed up. I don't think it's very hard to find something in any of those texts. But I also think if you explore deeply enough, you'll find good. And you'll find some commonality. You'll find that certain things are what is strived for. You'll even find some of the same people. So, no, I don't take the bait that we're going to tear down a religion and say this religion is awful. No, that's never what it's about. It's about regimes. It's about power structures. It's about oppression. And that is something that every liberal I know of is always willing to stand up and criticize, regardless of where it is. So if you hear somebody saying that, please correct them. It's not right. When you turn a blind eye to any regime, it is wrong. And unfortunately, I see a lot of people doing that with regards to what Russia is doing right now. And that is wrong. And you have to speak up. But ultimately, you know, it's up to the people there to make the changes. We can't go marching in and impose our will. You know, if we seem to think we can do that in the United States, no. You know, we can voice support, we can, you know, help out in various ways, but it's got to be the will of the people. The people who are affected directly.
Yeah, I think the differences in the time, too, with technology and what you're talking about with justice, you can document, we can talk about this stuff in greater detail with a lot more tools, and I think that's a distinction that is worth noting. Also, the frequency of reporting and having been able to witness all of this in real time, like very quickly getting information about changes and things that are being said, it's happening live, whereas in the last century, these things were slower, there was a delay, there wasn't necessarily the richness of detail about movements like this, the understandings of the interwovenness and the importance of messages, as you'd said. We're at a point where it's so high frequency in real time that we want to cut off the ability to get information out when regimes or whomever is unhappy with what's being said. We want to cut off that flow of information. That's a power thing that is kind of outsized for the strictures of democratic society. We want to be able to talk and stuff. So you know a lot of these rough edges in societies around the world are creating tumult. They're creating a lot of change rapidly in ways that we're able to document going back looking at it, but also as it's occurring. And I think there's an incredible amount of excitement about that. And it's made it wholly distinct from anything we've ever experienced in history. So that's, I think, something I'm also thinking about at the same time, just kind of making sense of it and seeing what is possible in light of that, how much more we know, how much better of understanding, how much we can verify and share and to try to be better and resolve things in ways that maybe we weren't as skilled at, whether it's Iran or other places. I mean, no one's going to go in there and tell them, but when people are not wanting to go to school and have something to say, it changes the dynamic. And that's really what's the theme, I think, in a lot of ways, just incredible dynamics all over.
Yeah.
Try to keep up and stay optimistic.
You know, I'd like to do that. I really would. This is Off the Wall. You can write to us, otw@2600.com. Talk about all kinds of things in our weekly hour. I do want to focus on something a little bit more optimistic, and going back down to Florida. Yes, it's possible. We can do that. Here's a place I just found out about called Babcock Ranch. It's 12 miles northeast of Fort Myers, where the hurricane hit, 12 miles northeast. But, they are what's known as America's first solar-powered town. It's a nearby solar array is made up of 700,000 individual panels, generates more electricity than the 2,000 homes that are in the neighborhood. In a state where most electricity is generated by burning natural gas, which, as we know, is a planet-warming fossil fuel. So when Hurricane Ian came barreling towards southwest Florida this week, it was a true test for this community. As we know, the storm obliterated nearby Fort Myers and Naples areas with a record-breaking surge and winds over 100 miles per hour, knocked out power to more than 2.6 million customers in the state, including 90% of Charlotte County. Babcock Ranch, the lights stayed on. The lights stayed on. It exceeded our expectations of a major hurricane, one of the residents reported. The storm uprooted trees, tore shingles from roofs, but other than that, not a whole lot of major damage. The residents say Babcock Ranch is proof that an eco-conscious and solar-powered town can withstand the wrath of a near Category 5 storm. We have proof of the case now because the hurricane came right over us. We have water, electricity, internet, and we may be the only people in southwest Florida who are that fortunate. Hurricane Ian came through southwest Florida like a freight train, but people there weren't afraid they would lose everything in the storm. We're very, very blessed and fortunate to not be experiencing what they've experienced in Sanibel Island and Fort Myers Beach. In the times that we're living in right now with climate change, the beach is not the place to live or have a business. But 2015 is when this solar array was built. It's run by Florida Power and Light. First residents moved into the town in 2018, and since then, the array has doubled in size. Thousands of people have made Babcock their home. It's a great case study to show that it can be done right if you build in the right place and do it the right way, said Lisa Hall of Babcock Ranch. Throughout all this, there's just so many people saying it worked, that this was the vision, this is the reason we moved here. And perhaps the highest endorsement for the city is that it's now a refuge for some of Ian's hardest hit victims. The state opened Babcock Neighborhood School as an official shelter, even though it didn't have the mandated generator. The solar array kept the lights on.
Oh, that's sweet right there. So poetic.
There's a lot more I could talk about here, but, you know, next time somebody tells you, yeah, you know, green energy, renewable energy, it's in the future. It's not developed enough now. This shows you it's developed plenty. Don't tell me nuclear is green. Oh, my God. It just really annoys me to see how many people are now embracing nuclear power and claiming that it's somehow green when you have a place in Ukraine that will not be habitable for another 20,000 years. It may not be black smoke, but it's plenty dirty. You have Fukushima. You have what almost happened at TMI. You have another nuclear plant in Ukraine that the whole world is worried about because Russia keeps bombing it. You know, if it's so safe, if it's so clean, shouldn't be worried that much. How about giving Iran access to nuclear power? No, you can't do that because you know what they can do with it. They can make nuclear weapons somehow. It's not something that's safe. Maybe one day it will be. But not now. And, you know, there's also the issue of nuclear waste that you have to store safely for hundreds of thousands of years. You really think we can pull that off? I mean, for God's sake, Jesus Christ lived 2,000 years ago. You're talking about several hundred thousand years, and we're going to keep something safe for that long? There are so many questions that need to be answered. You know, I don't get it. In the 80s, the 90s, smart people reached a conclusion. We shut down two nuclear power plants here on Long Island before they got built. And now I see people, intelligent people, saying, yeah, you know, it's better than coal. Maybe maybe it doesn't, you know, pollute the air as much as coal or oil. Okay. Doesn't mean it's the solution. Doesn't mean there's not something else that could be even worse if something bad happened. I wanted to quote something from the TV show Young Sheldon, where basically I think he was asking about nuclear power, and somebody said, oh, it's clean, it's safe, until something goes horribly wrong. That's pretty much it.
I think it's important to help people understand easy ways to switch and make it so that there isn't a market for nuclear power plants, because everybody's switched to running their own smaller scale community-based power generation. And I think that's the real answer. Heavy industry, they might have to come up with solutions on their own too. And there's a lot of diverse sets of technology. And I think running hybrid designs, like really, really complementary, symbiotic feedback loops, all these kinds of things, you've got to recover materials or elements or gas, electricity and energy recovery. All of those interesting things should work together. You have multiple options and storage. There's a lot of exciting, cool stuff, but you got to evangelize, share, help make it easy for everybody, and make it so that the excuse isn't, well, there aren't enough people on the new stuff, we have to have nuclear instead.
And then listen to those people who try to shut down the idea of solar and wind. Why would you oppose something like that? It's proven itself, and we can do so much more. Hey, otw@2600.com is our email address. We will see you next week. Stay tuned for Finn.
Bye, everybody.